Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's still open forum. So you can ask whatever you like, whether you're Catholic or not, about the Catholic faith. You want to know about the sacraments, about the Bible, about the popes. You want to know about Jesus himself. You are welcome to call 888-318-7884. This hour, nice. As promised, we welcome the president of the greatest publishing house. You're looking skeptical again, Mark, in the Alpha Quadrant. Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press. Hi, Mark.
Hey, I am so happy with you, Cy. It's really busy here trying to manage things over the Alpha Quadrant. Big, big region.
Big quadrant, but you got big things planned for it. Huge.
Absolutely. We got quite an email campaign for the Alpha Quadrant.
Have you got any books you want to tell me about today? Like, some days you don't come with a book that you're ready to talk about, and some days you do. I don't know. Do you have
any? I was thinking about that because Father Fessio and Vivian Doudreau and Joseph Pierce have the Formed Book Club, which is an Ignatius Press book discussion on the Formed platform, but it's also available on YouTube and other places like that. And they're talking about the City of God. I actually have a production copy. That's why it says production copy for those who are watching this.
Oh, yeah. And
this is the City of God by St. Augustine, but it's a selections and introduction by Hans Urs von Balthasar. So I've been reading through that anyway, and it was great to coincide with the launch. I was reading it before, but then they started reading it for the book club. And so I've been reading kind of along with it. So I highly recommend this. This is a classic, but, you know, usually it comes in an edition that's about, I don't know, five times as big. So this is an edited, selected edition, and which means that if you start reading it, there's like a much better chance you'll actually read the whole thing.
Yeah, right. I find the older I get, the chances are lower on any given book. I really want to get the odds up higher.
This is great. It's a great little selections of different aspects of St. Augustine. What am I talking about? It's a city in Florida. St. Augustine, I used to call him St. Augustine when I was a Protestant, you know.
I think a lot of people still say St. Augustine. Are we Philistines, those of us who say Augustine?
No. It's okay. It's an alternative translation or way of pronouncing it. But it's more common, at least in many Catholic circles, to say Saint Augustine, you can say Augustine if you want. Just don't say Augustine. So it's the City of God.
Augustine. Okay.
Yeah, and we also have Ignatius' critical edition of the Confessions of Saint Augustine.
Nice. Augustine. Did other people write books this long in the olden days? He writes very long books.
Yeah, well, Confessions is actually not that long. It looks thicker because this is a critical edition, which means not only do you have the text, but you have a lot of introduction and essays in the back talking about the text. But The City of God is a big book. He wrote it over the course of 15 years.
Yeah.
And it's dealing with the issue of the fall of the Roman Empire, or at least the beginning of the process of the so-called fall or collapse of the Roman Empire.
Right.
You know, what happens? You got pagan Rome for all those years, and it's very successful, becomes an empire and all of that. Then Christianity is legalized and then becomes the official religion, and you have Rome sacked, and then all kinds of bad things happen. So the argument from the pagans was, well, it's because we all became Christians.
Yeah.
The Roman gods protected us. Now that we're all Christians, or you guys are Christians anyway, look at all the bad things happening in the empire. So the City of God is kind of somewhat of an apologetic in response that deals with lots of other issues, but that's sort of the apologetical thread. This is an apologetic show. You know?
Yeah. All right. Well, and so so the book is – you can just go to Ignatius.com and look up City of God and you'll find it.
Absolutely.
All right. The number is 888-318-7884. Mark Brumley is our guest, and I feel like there was one other thing I was going to cover with you, but I can't think of it, so I'm going to go to the phones.
We could do that.
Yeah.
That's what we're here for.
Virtually everyone listening to the program is relieved when I go, let's go to the phones. They're like, finally.
Yeah, because they've been waiting.
He's done talking. That guy is done talking. Michael in Atlanta, Georgia. I don't know where listening, maybe on the Quest in Atlanta, Georgia, the big Catholic radio station down there. Michael, go ahead with your question.
Hello, Kent. Am I on?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You're on the air with Mark Brumley.
Okie dokie. Okie dokie. I think the last time I called, I didn't go through for some reason, but that's okay. Actually, I'm listening on the, I was watching on the Facebook, Facebook Live. So
well, I'm waving to you right now.
Let's see. Are you delayed?
Yeah. Yes, there is a delay. Don't watch it. It'll confuse you.
Yeah. They told me that. That's why they told me not to put it up. But anyway, the question I have, it's a biblical question, because I came across this passage, 1 Corinthians 15:29, which Paul writes, now if there's no resurrection, what will that do for those who are baptized for the dead? If the dead are not raised, why are people baptized for them? I figure that our Mormon brethren use that as their justification for their proxy baptisms of their family members gone before. But what is the Catholic interpretation of baptism for the dead?
Mark?
Oh, very good. Well, first of all, yes, this is in 1 Corinthians. I think you gave the reference, 1 Corinthians 15. Context is, well, let me read what the verse says. Verse 29, otherwise, what do people mean by being baptized on behalf of the dead? If the dead are not raised at all, why are people baptized on their behalf? So Paul's dealing with the question of the resurrection from the dead. He's saying, you go back to verse 12, he says, there's some people that are going around preaching that there is no resurrection of the dead. Because now if Christ is preached as raised from the dead, how can some say that there is no resurrection of the dead? But if there is no resurrection of the dead, then Christ hasn't been raised. If Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain and your faith is in vain. And later he says, you're still in your sins. If Christ is not raised, you're still in your sins. So that's a context for this. It's a discussion of the resurrection of Jesus. Paul responding to people who claim there is no resurrection of the dead. And so he's appealing to the example of Jesus being raised from the dead to underscore the fact that there is a resurrection from the dead. And he talks about several other things here, but then he comes down to verse 29. So now he's appealing to the practice of what's referred to here as being baptized on behalf of the dead in order to justify that there's a resurrection. So it's a perplexing text. As you say, Mormons sometimes appeal to it. Different interpretations that are sometimes given. One is that it's just an ancient practice that was outmoded, that some people were being baptized for their ancestors who didn't live during the time of Jesus. And so they would undergo baptism for those ancestors. Something akin to what Mormons do. Some people claim that this was an ancient practice in the church, not that Paul is approving it, but that he's referring to it. I don't find that all that persuasive because we see no other evidence of it anywhere else, and it just seems kind of odd. A second interpretation that's sometimes given is based upon the verses that follow. Paul goes on to say, why am I in peril every hour? I protest, brethren, by my pride in you, which I have in Christ Jesus our Lord, I die every day. And then he goes on to talk about how he's suffering and so on and so forth. Well, it's hard to make sense of that in the context of the resurrection. Perhaps Paul is saying, when he speaks of people being baptized on the behalf of the dead, he's somehow referring to baptism in the sense of suffering. So it would be the idea that these people are suffering or enduring a baptism of suffering for the sake of other people. So those other people who are either physically dead, who died, or who are spiritually dead. So that's another interpretation. The one that I think is interesting, and I'm not quite sure whether I buy it or not, is that the idea here is that if Christ isn't raised from the dead, then the act of Christian baptism then becomes, in effect, a baptism on behalf of or in the interest of someone who's dead. if Christ is raised from the dead, then our being baptized is not just a baptism into his death, as Paul says in Romans chapter 5, but also a baptism into his resurrected life. So what Paul would be saying here when he speaks of baptism on behalf of the dead, he's saying if Christ isn't raised from the dead because there's no resurrection, then when we baptize into the name or into the person of Jesus, we're baptizing into someone who's still dead. What point, what sense would there be to that? What sense would we make of that? So Paul is not saying that there is such a thing as baptism on behalf of the dead in the sense of somebody who's alive being baptized in the interests of someone who's dead, but he's saying that Christ is raised from the dead. Otherwise, when we were engaging in the action of baptism, we'd be baptizing people in the interest of somebody who's dead instead of in the cause of someone who's resurrected. So that wouldn't make any sense, Paul is saying. So we don't know exactly what he's talking about, but I think of among those interpretations, I would be more inclined to go to the last one and not see this as pointing to some early Christian practice of baptism on behalf of dead people.
Michael, I'm going to leave it there and say thanks because we have to do our first break. Our guest is Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press. They got a new edition out of The City of God. You can check that out at ignatius.com. We'll be right back with more questions for Mark after this.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
I don't like looking back. I prefer to look forward and keep moving forward. There's plenty to cover. I do a lot of research and try to dig out the bits and pieces of a life or of an agenda that people don't want to talk about.
The World Over with Raymond Arroyo. Tonight, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. If you live in the Alpha Quadrant and you got questions about the Catholic faith, today's your day. Mark Brumley is here, president of Ignatius Press, 888-318-7884. I'm going to do that for Lent. I'm going to make that a Lent thing. I'm going to say the number slowly for Lent. What do you think? I've already done some other things. I don't want you to think, Mark, that that's the only thing I'm going to do for Lent. I got some.
Is this penance for you or penance for other people?
Well, I guess it's a discipline more, a discipline of charity, because everyone says I say the number so fast they can't hear it.
Okay.
So I'll discipline myself in charity so that people can get the phone number.
I think
does that seem Lenten?
You're just saying it so fast. I think it's really your desire to be a disc jockey. And
yeah.
They talk fast, and so that comes through when you're giving out the number. But yeah, I think it'd be charitable for you to slow it down.
All right, I will do that then. And I don't really want to be a disc jockey. I just want disc jockey money. I just want somebody to come through with disc jockey money. George in Iowa, listening on Iowa Catholic Radio, you are next, George. Go ahead with your question for Mark.
Thanks. So I was wondering this questions about what free will is and what kind of world that we live in. And it's possible to imagine the concept of God intervening today, as you know, in the past he did in the Bible and such. If God were to tell someone what their future was, hypothetically, whether it's the major beats of their life or the immediate details of what they're about to do. Does that mean that informed with this information, a human would be, well, is there one future that someone is, even if they have information about it, they can't choose? A new future isn't opened up to them with that information.
Oh.
And they just become like a puppet that sees its strings. Or is it possible that being informed of the future means that we are therefore free to choose a different future, like acting on that information?
All right, I'm going to guess at Mark's answer, and then I'm going to let him answer. Not puppet on the string, because God doesn't do that to us. But I'm just guessing. Mark, what do you say?
So if I'm following, the question is, if I had perfect knowledge of the future, would I feel compelled to act in a way to realize that? Or could I act in a different way and thus make a different future? Is that the question? I don't think that you say if I have perfect knowledge of the future, if it's really knowledge of the future, what is going to happen, not a possible future, but what the actual future is going to be, then I don't see how I could do something otherwise. Because that's the future. If this is the actual future that's going to happen, but I think that it. I don't know that it's meaningful to talk about human beings having that kind of perfect knowledge of the future, because I think that there needs to be space for human freedom. So if it would seem that that kind of knowledge of the future for a human being would preclude a human being from having freedom. But I don't know if I've convinced Cy. He doesn't.
Let's put it this way. As a hypothetical, it seems to me that you're saying, as a hypothetical, if I know the future, I can't change the future, because then otherwise that would not be knowledge. But then you're following that by saying that hypothetical is not really possible for human beings, because that's not the kind of creatures we are, and that would eliminate our freedom.
Right.
Okay, then I totally dig what you said. What do you think about that, George?
Well, I've had those same thoughts as you have approaching this type of question. But the thing is, does that mean that logically God cannot choose to reveal that to us, right? Doesn't that create an implication, right? If the future has meaning, then therefore this thing cannot happen. But if you're outside of the universe, if you're outside of space and time interacting with someone, there's something preventing you from doing that. Then that means, what does that mean? Is God the source? If God is the source of his own actions, then he should be able to do whatever he wants with a person. Show them the future, tell them something.
Well, anything that's logically consistent with the nature of the person. I mean, you...
Right.
But the nature of God. Yeah.
Well, of the person, too.
We are nothing before God. Well, our will does not override what God can do.
All right, I'm going to let
Being outside of space and time is... That is
right. But,
all
but,
power.
But God can't make me be alive and dead at the same time in the same sense. God can't make me be 10 feet tall and 2 feet tall at the same time and so on. So, you know, there are things that do have to do with consistency of the person we're talking about, the nature of the person. So it's not just a question of what God can do. It's also a question of what God has chosen to do, and therefore he can't behave in a contradictory way. But with respect to the future, if we're positing that we know something is the future, that I have knowledge that this is going to happen, and I am involved in the thing that's going to happen, then that degree of specificity would limit me from doing otherwise. If I could do otherwise, then I wouldn't be knowing the future. But when we have things like prophecies in the Bible, those prophecies lack the kind of specificity and clarity with respect to particular recipients of that message, of those messages, so that their freedom is not impeded. They don't know how certain things are going to come about. They only know that they're going to come about, and therefore, when we talk about the future being involving a certain outcome, that's not in contradiction to people's freedom.
I think I'm going to leave it there. This is the kind of thing that I would talk about all day, but that would be unfair.
But
George, I thank you very much for the call. I hope that it has at least been somewhat helpful. Madison in Michigan, you are next watching on YouTube. Madison, go ahead with your question for Mark.
Hi there.
Hi, Madison.
Hey, thank you so much for taking my call. This is pretty cool. I love Catholic Answers. You guys do amazing work. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Madison. You can call anytime if you're going to say stuff like that.
Yeah, I will call all the time then.
Okay, good.
All right. So a few weeks ago, I was meditating on how there are at least a couple places in Scripture that I can recall where David is referred to as a man after God's own heart. Mm-hmm. And so that led me to think that in a way, David could be considered the first Sacred Heart devotee, if you will. And I brought this up to a fellow Catholic, and he kind of pushed back and said that since this was prior to the incarnation, that is an unreasonable statement. So I just wanted to see what your thoughts were on that. And I thought that it was especially fitting with the Sacred Heart devotion, since our Lord had allegedly said to St. Margaret Mary something to the effect of, that I set neither limit nor measure to the gifts of my grace for those who seek truth in my heart. And his whole point in pushing back was that God did not have a physical heart until the incarnation, but that the Sacred Heart devotion is more so about the mercy of God. So let me know what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I think your friend is right that the devotion of the Sacred Heart is focusing on the Sacred Heart of Jesus, and it has to do with the incarnate heart. We're not talking about the physical organ now. We're talking about the heart as the core of the person and what's at the core of Jesus in his humanity is his love for the Father, of course. But, of course, he wants to do all that the Father wants of him. And why did the Father send the Son into the world? God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him shall not perish but have everlasting life. So Jesus came as incarnate mercy. So at the core of Jesus's humanity is this merciful love of the Father being expressed by his Son. So that's what's at the heart of Jesus. But the heart of Jesus touching on the person and not just the physical or the human nature, I should say, not just the human nature, but on the person, because the person is the one who is the who has the heart, right? That's the second person of the Blessed Trinity. And the second person of the Blessed Trinity receives all that he is from the Father. So there's a certain way in which we can speak of, behind the Sacred Heart of Jesus and Jesus' humanity is the divine heart of God. And so that goes back to your point about David being a man after God's own heart. Different ways we can understand that. We say someone's a man after someone else's heart. We often mean by that someone who is like the other person or is devoted to the other person or is devoted to the things the other person is devoted to. And so David is a man after God's own heart in the sense that David is someone who's devoted to God and the things of God and what God's interested in. And so in that sense, we can also think of David as being someone who's passionate in bringing about what God wants to bring about and embodies what God wants and God desires. So if the heart of God and at the center of God or what's the way God relates to us, the deepest level of God's being is mercy and love and compassion for us, and that's what's behind the heart of Jesus, then we can in a certain sense say that David is a man after God's own heart and that he is, therefore, you know, at least in the biblical salvation history, as far as the term of heart goes, the first person that has kind of a devotion to the Sacred Heart, to the heart of God, and that he's driven by and passionate for what God wants.
Madison, how's that?
That's perfect. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. It was also timed perfectly. Here comes the music. But I'd like to send you Mark's book, The Seven Deadly Sins of Apologetics, not because I think you're going to commit any of the deadly sins. I just want to give you a nice gift.
You want to help her help others not do it.
That's right. That's right. Help others not commit those seven. So hang on. If you'd like to get the copy of Mark's book, The Seven Deadly Sins of Apologetics, we'll send it to you. Thanks, Madison, for a very nice call. Right back with more Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com. Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
The Eucharist is the greatest gift we have.
How much do you love Jesus and the Blessed Sacrament?
We'll talk about that tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
It's Lent. Blessed Lent to you and to all of yours. But even in Lent, we play the groovy music. We don't give up on the groovy music.
It's groovy, groovy Lent, man.
That's groovy, groovy Lent right now, yeah. I don't know if you could tell, Mark, but during the break, the gentlemen in the booth over there were turning the lights on and off, doing a light show in here.
It's amazing.
I don't know if I can continue with the show.
I thought it was wonderful. I was having a religious experience.
Were you really? I was having something approaching a seizure, I think, under those. What? Are you guys done? Can we do the radio show now? Are we done?
Oh. I thought I was going to get the fifth secret of Fatima.
It kind of looked like that, huh? Like, or the big man, like, I don't know, like a man of the future. No, we said done. Don't start up again just because Mark starts up again. Let's see where we're going.
I like the way you just smoothly went over the fourth secret of Fatima. You know, I say the fifth secret, you don't even bring it. It's like, I don't even want to know what Brumley's talking about.
I'm sorry, Mark.
Let's get it back to the show, man.
I'm so sorry. They really did bother me with the lights. So I'm not on my, on my game. And you know, my game is pretty low to start out with. We don't start at a high level. And then you upset me with a bunch of lights and...
Was this like Andromeda Strain moment? You get the reference there?
No,
see
I don't.
The movie
I think I've seen the Andromeda Strain, but
we don't want to go down that
rabbit
hole.
Do the astronauts bring something back to the Earth? Is that the Andromeda Strain?
No, a satellite, a space probe comes back down, and yes, it has a deadly thing.
Pathogen of some sort.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And
I like how you're trying not to give it away. It's like a 1972 movie.
Right.
And you're like, I don't want to give anything away to anybody.
It's a great movie, though. You guys can go watch it. But,
all right, all of you video people, tonight, Andromeda Strain, watch it.
These violent scenes in it was rated G. This is like an early... The early rating system, they give it a G rating.
Yeah, that's like the 1970s G rating. You're like, what? Today, yeah. All right. Well, the 1970s, they were wild in every way.
But there's a scene in which a woman who has epilepsy, you know, is affected by a flashing red light.
Oh.
So that was the reference to Andromeda Strain. So.
Yeah, I'm feeling a little postdictal here. After that, got to move on. Let's go.
Yeah.
I don't even know what line to go to. So we're just going to play line roulette here. Robert in Washington, D.C., watching on Catholic.com. We're glad to have you, Robert. Please go ahead with your question while I rest my eyeballs for Mark Brumley.
Yes, thank you. Wondering if anyone there is familiar, and great timing that we have the president of Ignatius Press, because he knows all about books, but
boy, does he.
Book, the Bible, the Quran, and science. Are you familiar with the title, the book?
What, you know, I'm familiar with the title, and I've seen reference to it, and even, I think, excerpts of it on the internet, but I can't speak to specific arguments that are found in the book. But I do know that basically what it's trying to do is show how the Quran is scientifically accurate, whereas the Bible supposedly is not scientifically accurate. So I know it does that. It purports to do that.
But of course,
neither the Bible nor the Quran is scientifically accurate in the sense that a science book is scientifically accurate. And so this is a kind of, I call it, I'm not trying to be offensive, but I call it cheap shot apologetics, you know, in this case, it's from an Islamic perspective. It's cherry picking particular items and trying to make the argument that those cherry-picked items in the negative side of the Bible are supposedly at odds with science, but on the positive side, the Quran supposedly supported by science. But neither the Bible nor the Quran sets out to do science, so it's irrelevant.
Right. So really just skimming the surface, saying here's a problem, and not taking the Bible in its full context and making arguments from there.
Right. And you find tons and tons of this stuff on the internet and in, I almost said popular apologetics. That demeans popular apologetics, frankly.
Yeah.
You know, so,
okay.
Okay, Robert?
No, thank you very much. It's difficult when you're looking for things to read that follow the church's teaching, and it's great that Ignatius Press is a good resource. In fact, I think I just heard Father Pacwa recently say that he likes the Ignatius Bible and uses that when someone asked him, what should I look for?
Dude, I was listening to the same show. I heard Father Pacwa say the exact same thing. And I forgot to tell Mark about it, so I'm glad you called, Robert.
Corroboration here.
Yeah, yeah. Robert, thank you very much. And looking for good Catholic stuff, you can go to ignatius.com. There's another website I want to give out. What is it?
Let's see.
Catholic.com. Thanks, Robert. Miguel in Arizona, you're next, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Miguel, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
So I have a question on Canon 1251, which is abstaining from meat on Fridays.
Okay,
He's getting his canon. Miguel is getting his book of canon law.
Looks like somebody swiped it out of my office. So.
Well, that's against the law to steal someone's book of canon law.
Yeah, but I think I'm the only guy in the building that has a copy, so people come in.
You probably have one of those computer machines somewhere in your office. Type it in there. All right, go ahead.
I think I know the Canon, but go ahead.
Go ahead, Miguel.
Is Canon law a big T tradition or a little T tradition? I'm assuming specifically Canon 1251 is a little T tradition that can be changed by the Pope or the council of bishops, right? But it says you're supposed to abstain from meat every Friday. And when I was growing up, it was like, oh, no, it's abstain from meat just on Lent Fridays and Ash Wednesday. But that's what it says, that you can abstain from it.
So let's back up just for a second, because I need to get some context here. You said when you're growing up, it was abstain from meat only on Fridays during Lent. Did I understand you correctly?
Do we lose him? Miguel?
Yes. Yes, I'm here.
Oh, so that's what Mark's asking you, not me. When you were growing up, was it the only time you abstained from meat was on Fridays during Lent?
Was during Lent.
Okay.
Yeah, during Lent.
Ah, okay.
You're younger than Mark.
But somebody pointed out to me that you're supposed to abstain every Friday, according to Canon 1251.
Got it. Okay. So let's put this in context. It is the case, according to Canon 1251, that let's read it, and this is the online version, so it's not the latest translation. Abstinence from meat or for some other food as determined by the Episcopal Conference is to be observed on all Fridays unless a solemnity should fall on a Friday. Abstinence and fasting are to be observed on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday. So this is speaking of the general law for the Latin Church. And it's true that you are to abstain from meat, but you notice that there is a qualification there that has to do with Episcopal conferences. And it is the case that you can substitute some other form of penance for abstinence from meat in the United States. That's something you may do. So Fridays are days of penance, and abstinence from meat is the general or usual form that penance takes. However, Catholics in the United States are allowed to substitute some other kind of penance. So it's probably the case growing up, you were not aware that Friday was a penitential day, I suspect. And the only thing that you took away from that, or you were told about that, was that you don't have to abstain from meat on Friday. And then when Lent rolled around, everybody underscored the fact that you're not supposed to eat meat on Fridays during Lent. So you interpreted that as meaning that Fridays weren't days of penance. There wasn't to be abstinence from meat on Friday, but this was something that only happened during Lent. But meanwhile, all along it has been the case that Fridays are days of abstinence from meat. It's just that lots of people aren't aware of that. They came away with, well, you don't have to abstain from eating meat on Friday. But they didn't come away with the idea that you had to do some other penance if you chose not to abstain from meat. And that's the situation that we're in. Nowadays, Catholics are generally, but not universally, more mindful of the fact that Fridays are penitential days, and many Catholics do abstain from meat on Fridays during the year. I generally do. If for some reason I don't, because maybe I'm going to somebody's house for a dinner party and they're serving me a nice big juicy steak or something like that, I will choose to do some other form of penance on Fridays. So does that help clarify how you came away with that impression growing up? Okay.
Right. That helps clarify it. And so that leads to the third part of the question is not following Canon 1251 a mortal or a venial sin?
Well, what are the conditions? What do you understand the conditions being for a mortal sin?
It has to be grave matter. Okay. You have to have full knowledge, and it has to be an act of your own will. You can't be coerced to do it.
Okay. All right. So is it grave matter if the church puts in place a general norm for abstinence for penance? I'm going to say yes, partly because of the nature of penance, but also because of the authority of the church. Okay. And the second question is, do people generally know that Fridays are days of penance?
Well, no, they don't.
And do the people who – do they generally know that they're supposed to abstain from meat or find some other form of penance for Friday? I don't think they do.
Yeah, same answer, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Right. So my conclusion is that this is a serious matter, but that most people are not well informed about it. They're not deliberately ignoring the church or thumbing their nose at the discipline of the church. They just don't know that it is what it is, or they think it's something, well, that used to be the case in the olden times, but nowadays we don't have to do that anymore, and we don't really even have to do any kind of penance on Friday. It's not that big a deal. I think that's how a lot of people think about it.
I'm sure that's true. Unfortunately, I think that's also how people think about Holy Mass, is that many people no longer know that they have an obligation to assist at Mass every Sunday. So those are the times we live in.
Maybe I remember I may have told the story before, giving a class for people who are going through the Archdiocesan program for ministry formation here in the Archdiocese of San Francisco. This was many, many years ago now. And one of the guys there obviously he's involved, serious level, trying to learn about his faith, involved in some kind of ministry formation. We were talking about the commandment that you have to go to Mass on Sunday, you know. That's how Christians or Catholics observe the Lord's Day, the commandment, keep holy the Lord's Day, Sunday Mass. And he said, really? You really have to do that? That's part of the way we fulfill that commandment? I mean, don't you just mean like maybe once a month or every other week or something?
Yeah.
I said, no, that's not it. Now, this is a good guy, well-intentioned, wasn't trying to be rebellious, just literally did not know that there was a Sunday Mass obligation. So, yeah, we got a lot of faithful mission to do.
We need some little nun somewhere to start a TV network and a radio network where we can just talk about these things so people will know.
Yeah. It's part of our discipleship. Penance is part of our following Jesus.
Right.
Observing penance and listening to the church and taking direction from the church is part of what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. Attending Mass, participating in the Eucharist, which is the source and summit of the Christian life, is part of what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. So that's why these things are serious things in their own right. It's also why we need to be taught about them and carry them out.
All right. Miguel, thank you again for the question. I'm late for the break. I got to take a break. We'll be right back with more questions. No, that was me. More questions from Mark Brumley on Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
I think EWTN News Nightly is beneficial in a number of ways. Not only do we provide the news of the day, but also thoughtful analysis on important issues. And it's all viewed from the lens of a Catholic perspective, something you will not find in mainstream media.
EWTN News Nightly with Tracy Sable, tonight, 9 Eastern, on EWTN Television and Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. For Lent, we decided on the last break, no music. Or it could be Zach couldn't find the music. I don't know which one. It was something like that. But I think for Lent, no music when we come back from the last break.
The music got raptured, man.
Oh. Got raptured. You know, I'll tell you what. There are some people who listen to this program who would love it if that music would get raptured. At least once a month, we get a note going, please, for the love of all that is holy, get new music. And we just ignore that because it's very expensive to get new music. And we like the music. Jonathan in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Jonathan, go ahead with your question for Mark.
I just want to say you're welcome. I also want to say I'm a former sabbiacontist. So I just want to say your show is really great. It brought me home. Anyway, so here are my two questions.
Wait, I didn't fully understand that, but I'm so happy you said what you said. But did you say you're welcome at the beginning? Because I said thank you for your call. Is that what I... Or...
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't... Sorry, I just... Jonathan, I didn't want to miss what you were saying. But so you were a sede vacantist, meaning you didn't believe that there was anyone sitting on the seat, the papal seat, papal throne. And now you've given that up?
Yep.
All right. Well, God bless you. And Catholic Answers played a part in that.
Yes, it did.
All right. I am so slow. It took me all that to put that together that everyone else got right at the beginning. Go ahead with your questions for Mark.
All right. So these two questions are a little weird, so I'm going to try my best to say it the best way I can.
Okay.
So a question that I never thought before was, you know, and this is a common objection, especially among atheists, that God created evil. And so I was looking at all the articles on Catholic Answers and everything, and it was talking about, you know, God creating himself and all these stuff. I'm like, my first question was, number one, can God create himself, like replicate himself? And it led me to another question was, and I know it sounds weird because I'm not an Arian. It was just something interesting. What's the best way to teach a person that Jesus wasn't like a created being? Because in the Nicene Creed, we say that he was begotten from the Father.
Okay. So two questions. Is God able to create himself? But you said replicate himself too, Jonathan, which seems like two questions. But you're saying, could God create another God like himself?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Were you asking, Mark, if God could create another God like himself? Or were you asking, did God create him? Oh, okay. Mark?
So God can't create another God like himself because God can't do contradictory things. So God is eternal, uncreated. So an eternal, uncreated being can't create a being that's not eternal and uncreated. See, there's an inherent contradiction there. An uncreated being can't be created by definition. So God can't do contradictions. So that would be a contradiction. So that's the first point. Then the second point had to do with Jesus and understanding.
How could you explain to someone that Jesus is uncreated, that he's the only begotten Son?
So I need to know who I'm talking to. So if I'm talking to someone who already believes that Jesus is divine, then it's a question of trying to understand what it is somebody believes. If it's somebody who doesn't believe Jesus is divine, then I have to know what that person thinks about God. So I'm not sure which. So Jonathan, who are we trying to explain how Jesus is uncreated to?
His friends.
Say that again, please.
My atheist friend.
Oh, okay. Atheist.
So an atheist.
Gotcha.
So you're talking to an atheist. So an atheist is saying, I don't understand the concept of how Jesus could be uncreated. So we're going to say, well, remember, we say that Jesus has two ways of acting. He is God. He's the uncreated God, second person of the Blessed Trinity, from all eternity. And he has, so we'll say, a kind of a God way of acting, that divine nature. And he has a human way of acting. Call that a human nature. That human way of acting is created, didn't always exist. Jesus' God way of acting, so to speak, has always existed because God has always existed. So an analogy that sometimes you use, C.S. Lewis is famous for this. He uses the image of an author and the characters of a story or a novel or a play. And God is the author of the play. And he writes himself as one of the characters into the play. He exists outside the play. His sphere, his time, so to speak, we know God is timeless. But as an author, you think the author's time is distinct from what happens in the play. It's a different the play or the novel or the story, time in that is different from the author's time. So God's author time is eternity. But he writes himself in as one of the characters in the story. And all he does, all the things as other characters in the story, do. He's a human being in that story, like the other characters in the story, human being. But he also has his life outside of that. And so we can think about the second person of the Trinity, or Jesus, in the incarnation, is kind of like that. God outside of the story, second person of the Trinity, as God, but as a character in the story, he's human, he's man. And so he has his way of being and acting in the story as a character that's created. And so that's one way of thinking about it. Does that help?
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you very much. And thank you for the kind words, Jonathan. I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
I'm going to get as many as I can on. The lines stay full. We're going
Let's go for it.
Western Australia. Jim in Western Australia, watching on Catholic.com. You there with us, Jim?
Hi, Si. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Are you near Perth?
Mark, I really... What's that?
Are you near Perth?
No, I'm not in Perth. I'm about 450 kilometers from Perth.
I got to go look up what kilometers are, because Americans don't know what that is. But all right.
Six tenths of a mile.
Oh, six tenths of a mile. All right.
We're near Walpole, between Walpole and Albany.
All right. Go ahead, Jim.
Mark, I really wanted to thank you for a production that Ignatius did called Did Jesus Really Rise from the Dead? My boys and I watched that at Easter time, and they really enjoyed it. It really made the reality of the resurrection, brought it home to them. So
beautiful.
Thank you for that.
Bravo.
Oh, good. I'm glad that was helpful to you.
Yeah. My question was, looking at history, in light of all the amazing inventions that we saw from the Greeks and the Egyptians before the time of Christ, is there an argument for non-believers, a convincing argument why they should believe that the church, the culture that the church created, is responsible for the advances in science through the Middle Ages into the modern era?
Well, there are arguments that are made. In fact, Father Stanley Yockey was a priest who was also a physicist, is famous for writing a lot of books on the history of science, and he argues that it was the Christian matrix, the matrix of the Christian faith, that gave a great deal of impetus to the emergence of science in the Western world. Obviously, there were other factors as well, but the church's invention of the university system, the beginning of the scientific method in Roger Bacon, who was an early, he was a priest, who was an early scientist and philosopher of science and so on, and late medieval scientific emergence of scientific techniques and ideas at the end of the Middle Ages and the early modern period really contributed to the emergence of science. I mean, it's more complicated than that, but I think if you look up the works of Father Stanley Yockey, that's J-A-K-I, he would be a valuable source of information on the subject.
Okay, Jim?
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that call and that question. That's one that we got to do a better job at. I'm so glad that Father Yockey did that work, but it's something that we have to do. I mean, there's people who really believe that the whole entire Middle Ages was an intellectual backwater. And that's, I mean,
that's
not
just false.
It's just false. Right. And not even a secular historian would say things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a complicated conversation, but yeah.
Why do you say it's a complicated conversation? Because the church's reactions to scientific advances were varied.
There's that, but there's also the fact that scientific knowledge, the emergence of science and more the scientific method, was something that occurred through many. There are many elements that contributed to that.
So I gotcha. Yeah,
it wasn't just the church. There were other things involved.
But, yeah. Well, you know, John Kennedy said success has many fathers, and so.
It does.
And I always like to close with the John Kennedy quote. Thank you, Mark Brumley.
Okay.
You're always doing good when you close with the John Kennedy quote. Mark Brumley is the president of Ignatius Press. You should check out all the stuff they have over at Ignatius.com. What was the name of the thing that Jim was talking about? Did Jesus Rise from the Dead?
Did Jesus Really Rise from the Dead? It's a video.
It's a video?
And there's also a book by Carl Olson, the same title.
Oh, the great Carl Olson. Did Jesus Really Rise from the Dead? Check that one out. Maybe you can do that with the kids around Easter time. Tomorrow, I think we're doing RCIA open forum. So you got to be in the RCIA, and then you can call in and ask anything you want. We'll see you then.